I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. In the era of Homeland and Breaking Bad, what explains the growing popularity for Downton Abbey? The PBS series set in early 20th century England. More than 10 million people viewed the fourth season opener on Sunday night. Besides being drawn into the lives of the Crawley family and their many servants, what can we learn about post-World War I Britain as their world undergoes a dramatic period of change? The rise of the women's movement, dwindling fortunes for the aristocracy, even new appliances such as mixers and toasters being introduced into the household. Well, we asked Jennifer Nesbitt to join us in this hour of Radio Time. She's Associate Professor of English at the Penn State York campus, where she specializes in 20th century British literature. And Jennifer Nesbitt, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And are you one of those 10 million people that tuned in on Sunday night?
Oh, yes, indeed. In fact, I saw it the first hour previewed a few days before.
So you got a little sneak preview.
Yes.
Why do you like the series so much?
Well, I like it because it reminds me of things that I have liked before. It's sort of a Pride and Prejudice translated into the 20th century, so it's a little closer to us historically, but it still has all those big themes of who's going to marry who and what's the inheritance going to be and how are these people going to manage their relationships. So,
what do you think explains this popularity in this country for the British aristocracy?
Well, I think that it's not actually that surprising that such an escapist mode of television would be popular in a time of an economic downturn. And Downton Abbey is, in fact, positioned right before a major economic downturn. It's not 1929 yet, but this is a group of people who's dealing with considerable social change and unsure where the future is going to take them. And I think you hear a lot of that in the media. Mm-hmm. Generally today about, you know, where is America going next?
But it seems that there's a particular interest in the kind of upstairs, downstairs world that's presented by Downton Abbey that is of particular interest to Americans.
Well, we like to think we live in a class-free society.
Sort of why I'm asking you the question. Yes,
yeah,
no, go
so
ahead.
I think we're fascinated by this, what we see as a very rigid hierarchical structure where everyone is supposed to know their place and that their destiny is determined by to whom they are born, essentially. And in the series, you see the kind of conflict that started America, which was people leaving England. That's the originary story for us, right? Leaving England, coming to the United States because they could not live the lives they wanted to in this strictly hierarchical structure, which forbids certain kinds of relationships, acts, behaviors, beliefs. So here we see in the downstairs, we see these rumblings. I don't want to be in this strict system anymore. We see it upstairs as well. So it has a particular affinity to Americans who believe in a sort of up by your bootstraps.
Yeah.
You can make your own destiny.
Do you think people identify with the upstairs or the downstairs?
I can only tell you based on my own experience with Downton Abbey fans. They seem to be attached to the upstairs plot lines, but to be very curious about the downstairs lives. So I think that people like the romance of upstairs, but they're also really intrigued by how the downstairs staff lived and what their relationships were really with the upstairs. So you kind of get both. Everybody wants to be Mary some days and they want to be Anna on other days. And it is primarily women. I don't get a lot of men coming up to me saying, gosh, I
sure
want to be Matthew. So,
well, I don't think anyone would want to be Matthew now,
yeah.
But I want their clothing. I have to say the costumes are just gorgeous.
Yes, the cast actually talks about that, that there's costume envy because the downstairs staff do not get the variety and luxury goods that the upstairs cast get. They've spoken about that.
Well, I do want to play a scene from season three, actually the season before this one, and this is with the pending arrival of Cora. That would be, you know, Mrs. Crawley, Cora's American mother, played by Shirley MacLaine. The Dowager, played by Maggie Smith, is explaining to the family the difference between American aristocrats and British. Let's listen.
I'm so looking forward to seeing your mother again. When I'm with her, I'm reminded of the virtues of the English.
But isn't she American?
Exactly. An aristocrat with no servants is as much use to the county as a glass hammer.
First of all, she's a wonderful snob. Would you not agree?
Oh, Maggie Smith? She's phenomenal. Phenomenal. And Shirley MacLaine knows exactly how to skewer her. And so it's great to watch the two of them together.
This is, and I do want to talk a bit about this period of history in England, and of course it's post World War I through most of this series. Does this series help us understand that time and place?
I think it does. Yes, the historical representation is pretty accurate. The one thing I think we do miss is that. Well, I know you want to talk about the nanny a little bit later,
yes.
But that there might have been harder to be a servant than it's depicted in this particular show. You see them sitting and talking to each other, and they're usually engaged in some sort of handiwork, and you occasionally see a bucket or something like that, but you don't get a sense of the long hours and the incredible difficulty of the manual labor and the amount of it that would be going on at this period.
So these are nice aristocrats, the Crawleys?
They are particularly nice and generous to their servants. In general, I think you would have had much more starkly created divides, particularly with the staff that was really downstairs, the daisies of the world, the staff that really didn't get seen upstairs ever at all.
Help us understand, I mean, the real-life world of the daisies, and she works in the kitchen, she's young, she's sort of innocent, naive, enthusiastic. It's hard not to have some empathy for her. Help us understand the real daisies.
Well, the real daisies were, well, first of all, I can tell you that there were 1.4 million people engaged in domestic service. It was one of the few opportunities for women at this time, and most of the staff was female. Daisy's unusual in that she would be working in a large country estate. Most households had many fewer servants, and therefore the range of tasks that she's asked to do is somewhat more limited than, say, a person who's on a staff of three. She could have been washing dishes for hours after a dinner. You see her toting heavy loads of wood, cleaning the fireplaces. This is very dirty work, and also backbreaking, and some of these people were quite young, and yet this was considered a path for a pretty good job, you know?
And we're talking about working, what, pretty much, I won't say 24/7, but pretty much all day and 7 days a week?
Yes. I don't have it right in front of me, but they got an afternoon off every so often. They had 2 weeks of vacation, you know, which doesn't sound so bad, but it was, you know, strictly limited. They didn't get to choose their time very much. They did have to be available essentially 24/7.
Well, I do want to play a scene, and this is from season four. A downstairs Daisy and the staff talk about the complicated position of nannies who are neither family nor servants. Let's listen.
I couldn't be a nanny.
Why not? Don't you like children?
No, I do. But being a nanny, you're not one of the family, but you're not one of us either.
What are you talking about?
Being a nanny. Daisy was saying she thinks it must be a lonely life.
Mm. I don't know about that, but if you ask me, that Nanny West thinks too much of herself.
Why? What's she done?
She always seems nice to me.
She only tried to give me orders.
You mean she mistook you for a servant?
But he's a servant.
Don't tell him that. He'll never get over the shock.
And again, a scene from season 4 of Downton Abbey. And in this new season, there is a nanny temporarily taking care of two children, George and Sybil. Help us understand the status of the nanny in these households.
Well, nannies and governesses were in fact in between. They were paid staff, but due to the fact that they were in charge of the children of the house, they had a certain amount of authority and more frequent interaction with the upstairs family. I think the case is more severe with governesses who were older and frequently came from the what we'll call the category of distressed gentlewomen. Mm. But nannies, at least in literature, nannies are filled with, their literature is filled with these imperious nannies who rule the nursery and terrify the servants and the family alike with their strict routine. And the nanny would usually have some assistance, and I think in Downton season 4 we see that nanny does have a nursery maid to assist her. So she would have someone to sort of act as a go-between between her and the downstairs staff, but really she was isolated. Nurseries tended to be at the top of the house, and so they would have been away from the other, spatially as well as hierarchically distanced.
Well, and there's this horrifying scene where you mm-hmm. see this. I mean, she's a racist. She's abusing the Sybil because she's mm-hmm. kind of a half breed, I guess, from her perspective.
Yes.
And George, who's purebred.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we know that racism is not purely the province of the upper class. So she seems to have prejudices that are stronger even than mm-hmm. Some of the family. And I think it's important to remember, and we can see this with the Irish most clearly, that there was a time when the Irish were thought of as black in a certain sense. So for her to call Sybil a crossbreed mm-hmm. is not that far off the mark and not completely out of line for the types of remarks that could have been made at the time.
About a minute before our first break here, what's a distressed gentlewoman?
you just mentioned.
Go ahead.
Well, women who came from the upper and middle classes but either had not a good dowry and couldn't marry, or whose father or the source of wealth had dried up, had to find some sort of paid employment. And the types of quote-unquote respectable employment usually were needlework, because these women could sew, and being a governess or a companion. But that meant that you lost status as a lady because you were no longer leisured. You were working. You were being paid. So you became a kind of there but for the grace of God go I figure in the household. It could create a lot of...
And we are talking about Downton Abbey, and also talking about what it tells us about real-life England at that time, the turn of the 20th century. Jennifer Nesbitt, Associate Professor of English at the Penn State York campus. And we have a guest, Amanda Dobbins, who will be joining us after this very short break. You can join us as well. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. If you're watching the program and you like it, if you have never watched it and you don't intend to, we want to hear from you. 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Longwood Gardens supports WHYY. This year, Longwood celebrates the holidays with a Longwood Christmas, fresh and in season, featuring fruit-adorned trees, 18,000 floating red and green apples in a mosaic, daily performances, and a 500,000 twinkling lights. A Longwood Christmas, fresh and in season, on view every day until 10 p.m., now through January 12th. Timed tickets are required. Tickets and information are available online at longwoodgardens.org.
The rapper Bubba Sparks grew up in rural Georgia.
Believe me, man, if it sounds preposterous to think of a country white boy being a rapper, imagine how absurd it sounded when I told my dad that, you know what I'm saying, in 1996.
Well, you can imagine how his dad felt when Bubba hung his first gold record on the wall. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'll talk to Bubba Sparks on the next Bullseye from NPR.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Next time on Here and Now, iconic Israeli singer David Broza's latest album tries to bridge the divide between East and West Jerusalem.
I wanted the Israeli musicians to face and see the Palestinian musicians that I met. And I was hoping they would all come together, which is what happened.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and we're talking about the popularity of Downton Abbey and what we can learn about post-World War I Britain in a time of political and social change. Again, Jennifer Nesbitt with us, Associate Professor of English at the Penn State York campus. She specializes in 20th century British literature. And joining us now is Amanda Dobbins. She writes for New York Magazine's Vulture blog, where she posts Downton Abbey recaps. And Amanda Dobbins, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're nice to have you. And Jennifer, we have you back, yes?
Yes, indeed.
Excellent. Amanda, are you a fan of Downton Abbey?
I am. I'm a devoted fan. And everything I write, even sometimes the more exasperated, it comes from a place of love. It really does.
And what do you love?
You know, I really... I'm a sucker for anything set in this time period. I love costume dramas. If it's between the wars in England, I'll watch forever. So the basic premise, they had me from the beginning.
It is, and I'll put this to both of you, but it is also seems to me a series that would be very easy to lampoon. Do you agree with that, Amanda?
Oh, absolutely, especially as it goes on. Downton Abbey uses its storylines very quickly. It doesn't really wander, so they keep having to kind of raise the stakes. And the stories are getting more and more ridiculous,
yes.
Especially last season.
Do you agree with that, Jennifer?
Oh, absolutely. Matthew rising from his wheelchair was one of the truly compelling and annoying moments. But, I mean, we just saw that, right? The old will-in-the-book trick. Well known to lovers of detective fiction, missing Will falls out of a book. I agree with Amanda. I love the show, but I do occasionally laugh out loud at some of the things that happen.
I turned to my husband on Sunday night and said, "You know, this really—it's just a soap opera. I mean, isn't that really what we're talking about, Jennifer? In all the best and all its glory, and you know, whatever the opposite of glory is."
I think it has its soapy qualities. It's Upstairs, Downstairs Revisited, right? Which was also kind of a soapy piece.
Soapy, so. Amanda?
Oh, I completely agree. And I think sometimes that's actually the fun part of it. Some of the more ridiculous storylines really do work, you know, and I am very excited, frankly, to see Mary dating again. Mm. I hope she's going to. Now that, you know, I was sorry to see Matthew go, but I will watch a ridiculous romance forever.
I really liked what you said, actually, Amanda. You said it's just the season four beginning is just like season one.
Yeah.
Yay. I thought that was great. I thought that's accurate.
Yeah,
that's what we loved about season
one. I appreciate that. Exactly. It is getting back to kind of the reasons that we started watching the show, which is, you know, can we save Downton Abbey, the estate? Does Mary get to be involved? Who is everyone going to marry? Which is... always an important question.
But Amanda, you also say that everything is Lord Grantham's fault.
Yes.
Add it all up, go ahead, do it on the air.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, I understand what they are trying to do. They're trying, you know, historically, which I think Jennifer can speak to, but they're trying to show a flawed system, an unfair system. But like I said, on Downton Abbey, everything gets out of control. So let me just read briefly recount a list of things that Lord Grantham has done wrong.
Okay.
He's mismanaging the estate. He lost all of his wife's money, so he's already had to get more magical money from poor Lavinia, bless her soul. He screwed up the Bates's murder trial. Obviously, there were a couple people that didn't testify very well, but he was not impressive on the stand. He allowed the weird, fake burn victim. I'm not really sure whether we ever knew if he was actually, back in season two, the one that loved Edith. Mm-hmm. he allowed that person back into his home. He had the whole affair with the maid, and he's always yelling at the women. So I'm fed up at this point.
Are you fed up, Jennifer? And does that sort of analysis meet your definition of Downton Abbey?
Everything is. Frequently, he is at fault. I don't know that I'm fed up with him. I think it's his job to be sort of recalcitrant about change and then to collapse under the strain of the new. I think that's his job, and we're supposed to see him as good-hearted but bumbling, and therefore still sympathetic even as his time passes, you know.
Well, let me play a scene from season four, and this is Lord Grantham believes Mary is just too fragile to help run the estate, and here he is assuring her that it's best if he stays in charge.
Do you want me at the tenants' luncheon tomorrow?
No, there's no reason for you to be.
I know you're trying to shield me.
Let me manage things in my own way, please. It'll be for the best.
I have ideas, you know. Matthew and I used to talk.
My dear, I know I'm right in this.
I'm in kind of a patronizing Lord Grantham, would you say?
Yes, exactly. I don't appreciate that attitude, even though he is looking out for her. I think we've learned at this point that he does not know what's best. He is not running this estate well. So...
Well, let me go back to you, Jennifer, because using this story to help us understand this, again, time and place, this is a time of pretty dramatic upheaval. The aristocracy, you know, losing some of the power, some of the money that they used to have. I guess the beginning of the decline of the British Empire.
You could see it that way. The literary critic in me thinks that probably Amanda's frustration comes from the fact that the things that Lord Grantham is saying to Mary are so transparently not true, and he knows they're not true, and so it just seems illogical at this point. You know, he's been through enough that he should know.
Yes.
Historically, though, I think that people, if you know anything about this period, you know that this is the beginning of the end. It's the long weekend, as Robert Graves will call it. And so we want to see that these attitudes that Lord Grantham represents continue, and yet we see that the writing is essentially on the wall. So I think historically it's doing what it needs to do, but as a piece of art of TV writing, it's very frustrating because it's just illogical based on what's gone before.
So, Amanda, you'll keep watching as the season continues?
Oh, of course. Like I said, you know, I will watch forever, but also I am optimistic about how they've set up the fourth season. And, you know, I miss Matthew, but we're going to get to explore a lot of the things that we liked about them. It's getting back to its roots, I guess. So I'm looking forward to it.
Let me reintroduce the two of you, and I do want to get some people, some callers in on the conversation. That's Amanda Dobbin. She writes for New York Magazine's Vulture blog. She posts Downton Abbey recaps. Jennifer Nesbitt, Associate Professor of English at the Penn State York campus. Again, she specializes in 20th century British literature. We're talking about the phenomenon, the popularity of Downton Abbey, and what it can tell us about changes in England at that time, Edwardian England after World War One. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coane. Jennifer, let me just go back to you, because one of the things that you have said about Downton Abbey is that it's really a show, a series about inheritance.
Mm-hmm.
Can you expand on that?
Yes. The Downton Abbey is essentially a country house novel. The question is, who will inherit the estate? And in this particular case, the estate is entailed along a path of primogeniture, so the first male heir, actually. Women cannot, by law, inherit. And what Downton Abbey combines is the sort of rising women's movement, new roles for women, and this retro practice of not allowing women to inherit, and he puts them in conflict. And so the question is,
who is going to be the appropriate steward for the estate. And initially it was resolved by marrying a sort of hard-headed middle-class lawyer into the aristocratic family through Mary. But now that Matthew is out of the picture, they have resurrected that plot. Is Mary a suitable caretaker, a steward for the estate as it moves into the 20th century?
And it's just interesting to underscore the fact that you could be very wealthy, very well connected, be part of the aristocracy in England at the time, and have very little actual power when it comes to things like inheritance, Jennifer.
Absolutely. I mean, which is why I think the Dowager is, she's a very interesting figure, because, not because she has the best lines, but because she shows how women had to manage their power, how they had to work back channels, make use of the connections that they had, marry well. And so I think it's a really interesting contrast to show how women of previous generations had to manage their resources and the opportunities that are not quite yet available to women like Mary, but are slowly becoming available. And of course, we, looking back from 2014 now, see that we sort of know what's coming. So it's kind of an interesting look back, I think.
And I would have to say, Amanda, that Maggie Smith steals every scene that she's in. She gets great lines.
Absolutely.
Well, let me get some call.
You know,
she's fun to watch. Let me get actually, we have a tweet from Eric. How did the circumscribed lives of the English servants compare to the experience of slaves in the United States? And Jennifer, that sounds like a question for you. Is there a way to compare?
Yes, there is. Now we're in. Slaves were, quote, not paid, well, not quote even, they were not paid, and they did not have a relationship with their the persons who employed them where they could leave. Servants could leave. So there's a fundamental difference there. The type of work that servants did was probably similar, but I think there's a big difference between being told that you must and will do this work and having the option. So I like to be real careful about making those comparisons. Yeah. But it was frequently done rhetorically by people agitating for workers' rights or women's rights. They would say, you know, women are essentially slaves, and there's been a lot of debate about making that kind of rhetorical move.
Let me get Robert from, it looks like Ballykinwood, to join our conversation. Robert, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello.
Hi, though.
My mother was in service in Scotland pre 1914, so this is a little relation to that.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
She always spoke about how unkind the gentry were, and that they, in her Scotch accent, would say that they keep me down. So this watching Downton Abbey has always seemed to me like her work, it was a little bit too good. The way that the servants were treated in such a lenient and kindly way by the Crawleys. So she talks about a lot of things that I guess she worked in the kitchen. So there were scullery maids, and there were all sorts of other things. There were also a lot of chamber pots, I'm sure, to be carried and emptied too, which they don't show in Downton Abbey.
Indeed, they do not. Robert, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Amanda, you want to respond to Robert's comments? And others have said that this is a kind of a, you know, cleaned up version of what downstairs was like.
Yes, of course. And I think the main thing to remember is that it's a TV show, and if they were all horrible all the time, we would hate them and wouldn't want to turn on the TV every week. So I fully believe that it's been cleaned
sanitized
up and made more appealing.
Robert, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Joan from Germantown has to say. Joan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, I just find a little strange, maybe discordant in a way, how easily Robert and Cora are manipulated by their lady's maid and their valet. It seems as though it never crosses their mind that these particular servants might have some self-interest in, you know, trying to influence their behavior. And I wonder if, I don't suppose there's any historical record of that kind of thing, but I was just wondering, sure, you know, what your guests thought.
Well, let me see what Jennifer Nesbitt thinks. Jennifer, what do you think?
Well, I think that there's plenty of evidence in the literature. The scheming servant is always a character, as well as the sort of the idiotic master, Jeeves and Wooster being a major modern version. I think it's you could look at it two ways. One, Cora and Robert essentially might not think of their servants as people in the same way that they are people, and therefore they don't have the same political motivations that they do. We can see this in the dowager who wants to get Molesley a position with her friend,
right,
and has him come help her butler, but she doesn't bother to say anything to the butler. And so the butler totally ruins the plan because he has no knowledge, but the dowager doesn't think that she ever has to tell her butler anything. So you can see it actually in action there,
If I could...
Go ahead, Amanda.
If I could just add, in a rare moment of defending Lord Grantham, he does seem to notice that O'Brien can be up to no good, and he is suspicious of O'Brien on occasion and expresses that to Cora. So I think maybe each person is aware of the other servant's failures.
Let me throw out, we have about a minute or so before we have to take our second break here, but let me ask you about Edith, and perhaps I'll put that first to you, Amanda. She looks like she's kind of coming into her own in this new season.
Yes, I'm very excited for Edith, although I am nervous, and, you know, maybe Jennifer can speak to this, because if the editor is moving to Germany in the 1920s, I don't know how that's going to turn out for them, and I'm almost curious whether it's going to be a Mitford situation, and that she's going to, I don't know whether they're going to become sympathizers, but I'm curious where you think it's headed, Jennifer.
Yeah, what do you think, Jennifer?
Well, I think they're setting it up that way. I mean, Edith is already nervous. I think my feeling about how that things will go badly is more narrative. Things have to go badly. You know, she's too happy right now, and so some complication must ensue. The 30s are, of course, a more dangerous time, and we're not there yet, but it's a very difficult time to be in Germany. A lot of animus toward the rest of Europe, so I think things could get ugly pretty fast.
Well, let's take that short break. Amanda Dobbins, we have to say goodbye to you. Thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. She writes for New York Magazine's Vulture blog, where she posts Downton Abbey recaps. Jennifer Nesbitt staying with us for the rest of the hour. Associate Professor of English at Penn State's York campus, specializes in 20th century British literature. We're talking about Downton Abbey and England at the turn of the century. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Delaware Valley College supports WHYY. For individuals considering certification to teach in public schools, Delaware Valley College offers PACT, the Post-Baccalaureate Accelerated Certification for Teachers program. The PACT program features 7-week classes on Tuesday and Thursday evenings, entry-level classes online, and an accelerated schedule that can be completed in 14 months. A full-time term of student teaching is required. Students may apply for the summer term now. Full details at delval.edu/PACT.
You must forgive Mary.
I do forgive her.
She is broken and bruised, and it is our job to wrap her up and keep her safe from the world.
Downton Abbey is back. On the next Fresh Air, we feature our interview with the series creator, Julian Fellowes. He'll talk about his own aristocratic background and the class distinctions this series explores. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
a new style and approach at the Federal Reserve.
Janet Yellen has made it very clear that she is interested in kitchen table economics.
Rana Faruhar of Time got the first interview with Janet Yellen partly because Yellen would rather reach ordinary Americans than talk to CNBC or The Wall Street Journal. The new Fed, next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Jennifer Nesbitt about all things Downton Abbey. Taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me play another scene from the current season, season four. This is in the kitchen, and Mrs. Patmore and Daisy are discussing the arrival of a new electric mixer.
But why would we need it?
It's a mixer. It beats eggs and whips cream and all sorts.
You and Ivy do that.
And we'd be glad not to, thank you very much. Lady Edith say why she got it.
Oh, her ladyship asked her to.
She wants to save us a bit of elbow grease.
I don't understand. Before too long, her ladyship could run the kitchen with a woman from the village. What with these toasters and mixers and such like, we'd be out of a job.
Jennifer, she's right. Mixers and toasters did change life in the kitchen.
They did, indeed. And it gets even worse after World War II.
With even more appliances. I mean, looking at this period through, I guess, products and technological changes, it also is a time of pretty dramatic upheaval.
Yes. In the media, you get radios and all sorts of things going on as well. Much as you really can't call World War I a rehearsal for World War II, and you know, which truly inaugurates the contemporary era, you do start to see how this way of life is going to fall apart based on simply the changes to the way labor is taking place. So
we were talking about Edith before the break, and she drives a car.
She drives a car.
Her older sister doesn't do that.
Right. Well, Mary might be considered to be mentally modern, but she's very much a supporter of the traditional social ways. She takes advantage of changes when they are to her advantage, but she still has so much to gain as the eldest daughter by maintaining her position that she really does have a double allegiance in that category.
We have an email from Edward. I enjoy Downton Abbey, but I was watching Remains of the Day last week and was amazed at how much better it was. Can they comment on this?
Oh, I haven't seen that movie in 100 years. I did hear Emma Thompson speaking about it the other day, but I haven't seen it in so long that I couldn't really comment.
Let me see what Mary from Burlington has to say. Hi, Mary. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, hi.
Hi there.
It was briefly mentioned earlier, the parallels with the Mitfords, Nancy, Jessica, and then the other sister, whose name I can't recall, who did wind up in Germany before World War II. And, you know, I just, that was ever since the beginning of the Downton Abbey series, I was thinking how similar, you know, with the three sisters, the plot lines were. The other thing I noticed is that they don't, you know, these were extremely wealthy Brits in a country house, and there's no fox hunt.
And there's no fox hunt.
Right.
Well, would that be unusual, Jennifer?
Well, they do hunt, though. You see that in the first season.
Right.
So, and it's the hunting is referred to. I'm assuming that's primarily a production decision, choosing perhaps not to work with horses.
Oh, just because it's more complicated.
I don't think that they don't hunt, because there's a discussion between Mary and Matthew where Mary says, "Of course he doesn't hunt," or "Of course he doesn't ride." And Matthew says, "Of course I ride." And she says, "But do you hunt?" So it's very definitely there.
Lady Rose is a relatively new character. How do you see her in this Downton Abbey series?
She is the person who creates chaos.
She's trouble. in their world.
She is meant to be the bright young thing, the flapper, a little in advance of that term, of course. And she wants to explore all these new things that are available to young people, and she isn't always very thoughtful about the implications, because she doesn't have to be. Mm-hmm. So I think that she's going to generate a lot of drama and interest in the show, and also some perhaps interesting fashion choices.
Indeed. But sort of representing a certain kind of person at this time period?
Yeah, fun-loving, young, the young people who benefited from the freedoms that were afforded to young women of all classes during World War I, when they were able to go out and work and live on their own. And so afterward, the door was opened to different kinds of entertainment, and it was very hard to keep them down on the farm, as it were, after they've seen the big city.
Indeed.
So I think that she represents that.
Let me get Catherine from Newfoundland, Canada, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Catherine. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Marty. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I wondered if Jennifer could comment on the generally tolerant attitude toward Thomas's sexuality that's demonstrated by really all the members of the family and staff, and how realistic that would have been.
Interesting question.
I think they're extremely tolerant. There's reference made to the Wilde trial, the trial of Oscar Wilde in late 19th century, where he was essentially imprisoned and died as a result. So I think that open acceptance of homosexuality is a little further on down the road, but there is a certain amount of tolerance. Because just as long as things aren't too overt, a tolerance that seems to be aligned with class and privilege. And the charge of homosexuality is usually deployed when you want to get someone in trouble and create a scandal, which is, in fact, what happens with the case of Thomas. But I think there's another element here which goes along with that rosy view of upstairs-downstairs relations, which is that we want to see these people as nice.
Ah, indeed.
And more like us and tolerant. And so that's why you get Carson to hold the place of unaccepting person, and everybody else making remarks like, oh, really, that, you know, that's, how could he even think that wouldn't be happening, and so it allows Carson to act as a foil for everybody else.
Catherine, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, and again, that phone number 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. We're talking about all things Downton Abbey with Jennifer Nesbitt. What, and perhaps this is the kind of stereotype of the British aristocracy, what always strikes me, and because I've been a fan of Breaking Bad and Tremé and, you know, Homeland, is all the things that are not said by either, well, probably largely by the Crawleys and people of their ilk.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like repression, denial, that stiff upper lip.
Yes, I think that that's to me one of the charms of the show is how little they say and how much these actors manage to convey without speaking. And in a lot of contemporary television shows, particularly the soapy ones, there's too much talking. I mean, I've heard such wisdom come out of the mouths of 17-year-olds as I hope maybe to have when I'm 60. So I actually think their inability to put it into words is sometimes a bit more honest. But you're quite right. They are. They do have the traditional stiff upper lip. Right. We will not speak openly of our feelings because that's rude.
Let me get Gregory from Doylestown to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Gregory. Go ahead. You're on the air.
It's been touched on already, but I think the popularity of these costume dramas tell us as much about the times that embrace them as the times they attempt to portray. The prototype for Downton Abbey, Upstairs, Downstairs, which was produced in pre-Margaret Thatcher, very pro-labor Great Britain, the sympathy was with the characters below stairs. And in fact, they got as much, if not more, screen time than the folks upstairs. And the real villains in the piece were these callous, self-absorbed aristocrats who ran roughshod over the people under them. In Downton Abbey, I mean, a chauffeur marrying into the family and ultimately being accepted, you wouldn't have seen that in the 1970s. And I think it, you know, that Americans with our celebrity-obsessed, wealth-obsessed culture of today, where we see on network television people prostrating themselves before Donald Trump in order to get recognition or a job, I think Downton Abbey is very much reflective of that popular culture.
Well, that's fascinating, Gregory. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Jennifer, you want to add to that?
I would agree that there's an element of this interest in... he said so many interesting things that I'm trying to keep them all in my head.
Well, I think one thing is just in the upstairs, downstairs time, audiences identified with the people downstairs because the people upstairs were so vindictive.
Right.
And unappealing.
And it's a little, that show is a little bit before my time, so I'll shift it slightly because there was a remake of Upstairs, Downstairs that was, came out right after Downton Abbey. And it was not as successful, and I think partially because the people who live upstairs are not seen as tremendously nice. Mm. And the servants also, because the class lines are much more strictly drawn, also don't come across as sympathetically. And that series has, I think it's had a second season, but I don't know if it's going to have a third season. It's a much darker series, and it goes up to the Second World War, and so things get dicey there. That's the real Mitford one right there.
Indeed. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. We got an interesting email from a dot. The current hunting ban in England probably makes having hunting scenes difficult or perhaps even impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Makes sense to you? Possibly?
Possibly. I don't think that it's impossible to show scenes related to hunting with horses, as they do in the first season. Mm-hmm. They have, you know, they show everyone gathered and having the sort of the cup of before they go off on their horses. So there are ways of getting that done in terms of the production without incurring huge amounts of cost and or violating current law.
Dot, thanks for that email. Jennifer, do you have a sense of what's ahead in season four?
Only what I've seen in terms of casting decisions. There's a governess in the works. I know that race relations are going to come into play. The series will get its first black character, and there are going to be a couple of cameos. Virginia Woolf apparently makes an appearance, and so does Dame Nellie Melba, the opera singer.
Huh?
So I have run across a few spoilers because of the research I've been doing to do the talks, but I'm trying not to find out anything. I don't want to know.
Well, and we don't want you to tell us either, but it's nice to know that there's some interesting new characters coming this season. Let me see what Ariel from Ardmore has to say. Ariel, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I was interested to know, I know that the nanny was caught abusing one of the children. And I remember also the movie about King George and I think the King's Speech, and it mentioned that he was abused by his nanny as well. And I was wondering how common it was that nannies were caught abusing kids and what families did about it, if there's any record of that.
It's an interesting question. Jennifer, have you looked at that at all?
I haven't really, but as I said before, the vicious nanny is a mainstay stereotype, and I don't think you have to make huge leaps between then and now and the prevalence of child abuse to think, you know, that this is not, it's just a different manifestation of the same problem that we face socially today, that there are adults
who take out their problems on children.
On little
because
children.
Because they can.
Thanks, Ariel. Let me get David from Central New Jersey to join us. David, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Okay, yeah, I don't want to make too many sweeping generalizations, but it's almost like there's an economic line drawn between the vitalness of relationships and love based on economics. So in Downton Abbey, I think there's a much, there are a lot of feelings and there are a lot of relationships among the upper class, but the most vital emotional relationship is between Bates and Anna. And when you look at the remains of the day, it's two servants, and so much of it is unspoken and unfulfilled. But the vitalness of emotion almost seems to be associated with being poor, like a lot of things for people who don't have as much. The more you have, the less important kind of everything becomes, and you can be a little more flip about everything. But Bates and Anna's relationship is by far, to me, the most intense, vital, emotional relationship in the whole thing. And Mary has a lot of feelings, and her sisters, too, but I don't know. There's almost
an economic line drawn. I hear you, and it's an interesting comment. Jennifer, you have 30 seconds to respond. Go ahead. Sorry about that. Love and economics.
I think beware. I guess what they don't have in cash, they get in feelings. But I'm not sure that simply because the feelings are not expressed openly, that doesn't mean they're not there. It's just that downstairs, they are seen to have more options because, as Anna says, I'm not a lady. So she can do things.
Very good accent there, Jennifer Nesbitt. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can carry on this conversation by leaving a comment on our homepage. And while you're there, you can check us out on Twitter, Facebook, the archives, how to listen to the show on satellite radio, and you can download podcasts. I'm Artie Moscoane. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.